Hello everyone and welcome to this seminar on lives and livelihoods, estimates of the global mortality and poverty effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. My name is Kirsten Sainbruch. I'm a Distinguished Policy Fellow at the International Inequalities Institute at the LSE. And I'm here to introduce Benoît, who will be giving this talk today. The International Inequalities Institute at the LSE brings together numerous researchers from LSE departments and centres to lead critical thinking and cutting-edge research that will help us understand why inequalities are escalating in various areas and on various issues around the world, and to help develop critical tools that can help address these challenges. Benoît Desserf is an assistant professor of economics at the University of Namur in Belgium, and he will be joining the development research group of the World Bank in early 2021. Benoît holds a PhD from the Université Catholique de Louvain, and his research interests focus on welfare and poverty measurement, public economics, and mechanism design. The presentation of this research, on which there is an III working paper co-authored by Benoît with the III's director, Francisco Ferreira, and with Daniel Mahler and Oliver Sterk. And the link to this paper is going to be posted on the chat, in the chat of this event. Benoît is going to talk for about 40 minutes, and then there will be an opportunity to ask questions at the end of the presentation. So please type your questions into the Q&A function of Zoom. And also please note that this event is being recorded. If you would like to receive information about upcoming events, please do sign up to the III newsletter, and you can find a link to that as well in the chat function. So with that, Benoît, hand this over to you.
Okay, thank you very much, and thank you very much for the invitation and the opportunity to talk in this very nice seminar series. So, as mentioned, the research I'm going to present is joint work with Francisco Ferreira at LSE, Daniel Mahler at World Bank, and Olivier Sterk from Oxford University. So, what we do in this paper is to, what we try to do is to evaluate the welfare consequences of the COVID pandemic. So there is no doubt that this health crisis has generated huge welfare consequences, if only through its mortality and economic losses. And here, what we want to do is to assess the relative size of the welfare losses coming from the two sources. And the reason we want to do that is that some policy response may imply a trade-off between lives and economic costs. Just let me make clear at this stage that not all policy responses imply such a trade-off. For example, developing a vaccine would be better in terms of both dimensions, but there are some policy responses that imply such a trade-off. Very recently, there was an old debate that started again when three public health experts published a petition which they called the Great Barrington Declaration, where they typically advised the governments to let the coronavirus freely spread into the population, into the young population, in order to reach herd immunity while trying to minimize its mortality. And the idea there is that the other costs of lockdown might, first of these costs are the economic costs, of course, but these other costs might not be negligible when we compare them to mortality. But it's not uncontroversial. There has been another petition by other public health experts saying that this may not be a good idea and that instead governments should try to do everything they can in order to suppress the spread of the virus. But okay. Here, what we want to do is to able, if we want to evaluate a policy which implies such a trade-off, we need to assess the relative magnitudes of the two sources of welfare losses. And what we will be particularly attention to is to try to do it in a way that can inform the public debate. And there is a big difficulty whenever we try to evaluate economic costs with human life. It is that we need to put them, the two of them, in the same units, if you want to compare them. And traditionally, there has been three main approaches that economists use in order to make such comparisons. And we argue that none of them are really fit in order to inform the public debate. So the first of this approach translates the human lives lost into dollars by attaching a price to a human life. And that's the value of a statistical life approach. And for instance, you would say, okay, one life lost is the same as losing $5 million, for instance. And the issue with this approach is that many people find the mere idea of putting a price on human life repugnant. And the people will feel that human life is priceless, and so this kind of approach is simply dismissed. Not to forget also another issue with this approach is that it completely disregards the distribution of economic losses in the population. So another approach that has been used is to look at the indirect mortality costs of economic losses. The idea here is to translate economic losses into human lives by the fact that whenever there are economic losses, maybe government has lower revenues and cannot finance public health system as it used to be able to do. And so this translates into higher mortality. Or also the fact that economic losses put people into difficult situation, say poverty, that we know that people in poverty, they live shorter lives. And so this has also indirect mortality consequences. And one difficulty with this second approach is that it is based on strong assumption on the reaction of individuals and governments to these economic losses. And for instance, the literature that has investigated what were the mortality consequences of the Great Depression 10 years ago, surprisingly found that in fact it did not, so the crisis did not increase mortality, but rather reduced it. And mostly they conclude that it comes from the fact that people react, they change their behavior after such a strong shock. And then there is a third approach, and this third approach is a social welfare approach, where social welfare is defined as the expected lifetime utility. This sort of approach, it has a very strong theoretical and ethical foundation. And the idea is to translate human lives and economic losses into utility units, lifetime utility units. And there are two difficulties here. The first is that beyond economic research, very few people understand what is this approach. And so people cannot judge by themselves whether the trade-off embedded in the approach is relevant or not in their views. And a second issue is that whenever you apply it, you need to find values for a bunch of parameters ranging from a discount factor, a curvature of the period utility function, which tunes risk aversion and the likes. But there is no parameter that directly captures the trade-off you are interested in. So the approach that we follow in our research is to make an approximation of a social welfare function evaluation. So we use the third approach, but a simplified version of it. Hopefully this version will be understandable in public debate. And another advantage is that in this simplified approach, we express the key trade-off using one transparent normative parameter. And in this approach, what we do is that we will express the two sources of cost into a unit which are the years of human life. And when looking at mortality, we will compute what is the number of years of human life lost due to COVID-induced mortality. And when it comes to economic losses, we will compute what is the additional number of years that people will spend into poverty. I will come back to this definition in a minute, but first, I want to mention that once we have computed a number of lost years and then a number of poverty years, we cannot directly compare them because it is unclear that the welfare cost of a lost year is the same as the welfare cost of a poverty year. In fact, then the comparison of the two welfare losses will depend on the normative normative parameter alpha, which captures exactly this. So alpha, it captures how many poverty years are deemed equally bad as one lost year. So if you want to make a personal opinion of what would be your value for alpha, we have developed this thought experiment which may help you. So the question that you have to answer in order to know your value of alpha is the following. How many years of your remaining life would you be willing to spend in poverty in order to increase your lifespan by 1 year? And we see the trade-off in terms of number of poverty years that are equivalent to one lost year. And importantly, because the alpha will be a subjective parameter, it's a normative parameter, we will try to stay agnostic with respect to the values, to how many poverty years are as bad as one lost year. But we argue that there is a minimum there, that alpha should be at least equal to one. And this derives from the idea that being dead should be deemed at least as bad as being poor. I will again come back to this. So the type of question that we want to raise in our that we will raise in this research are the following. So first, we want to have an idea as of June 2020, what are the relative sizes of the poverty and mortality consequences of COVID-19, and we will want to compare these magnitudes across country to see whether they vary systematically. And a second question we will want to ask is, okay, what we observe as of June 2020 incorporates interventions by government, but what if government did not react at all? Would it have been a good idea to not intervene when we compare? Was it a good idea not to intervene? And for this, we will try to assess what would have been the welfare consequences of no intervention and compare them to the welfare consequence as of June 2020. And we will also try to look whether the answer to this question varies systematically as a function of GDP. Okay, let me maybe directly give a preview of the results that we find. So as of June, the first result is that poverty is in most countries the dominant source of welfare costs. So for instance, in two-thirds of high-income countries, there are 10 times as many poverty years as lost years. At least that is what we estimate. And in fact, it is often the case that there are even more than 100 times the number of poverty years than the number of lost years. And this this ratio of the number of poverty years divided by the number of lost years, it is even higher in developing countries. It is often above 100 or 1,000. And to the extent that, say, 100 poverty years, so if you assume, let's assume that your value of alpha is 3, which means that you believe that 3 poverty years are equally bad as one lost year, then if we find that there are 10 times as many poverty years as lost year, then you will agree that the dominant source of welfare cost is poverty. And in my own country, which was the Belgium, which is the most affected in terms of mortality as of June, we find that this ratio is 3.6. So then in this case, if you think that alpha should be equal to 3, then you would, the two sources are more or less equivalent in terms of their welfare costs. So then, in terms of the no intervention scenario, what we find is that no intervention would have had worse consequences than the estimated consequences as of June. And this is particularly true in high-income countries. So if we look at high-income countries, we estimate that the number of years of life lost under no intervention would have been larger than 3 times the sum of poverty years and lost year as estimated in June. So if again you assume that one lost year cannot be better than one poverty year, then you must conclude from this empirical observation, from this estimation, that no intervention would have had worse consequences. So that is, we find no evidence for the idea that the cure has been worse than the disease. And a last finding that we have in this research is the fact that when we look at the relative sizes of lost year versus poverty years, mortality and poverty, the relative size there, we find that it varies a lot as a function of GDP. And the reason is that mortality, potential mortality, is much larger in high-income countries than in low-income countries. And this comes from the fact that they have very high-income countries have much older population pyramids, and COVID mortality is very concentrated among the old. And also from the fact that at a given age of death, the residual life expectancy is larger in high-income countries than in low-income countries. Another reason why we find different magnitudes is that poverty is a much more sensitive issue in low-income countries, which is not surprising, because in these countries, incomes are much closer to the poverty line. So for a given economic shock, much more people cross the poverty line in these countries than in high-income countries. Okay. I will now show how our conceptual framework is an approximation of a social welfare evaluation. So here we will look at the future lifetime utility of an individual I that lives in 2020, when the pandemic starts. And the remaining lifetime utility of an individual is the sum over his remaining years of life of the utility that he experiences in each year of life. So assume that the individual will die in 2050, which means that he has 30 years to live. So in each year, he will have a utility that in our framework depends on his or her status. It can be either poor or non-poor. And so the remaining lifetime utility is the sum of the period utilities over the 30 periods. And now we are interested in how the pandemic may affect the lifetime utility of this individual. And it can affect this utility in two ways. First, it can have poverty consequences if for one or more years following 2020, because of the pandemic, the individual becomes poor. That is, if the pandemic changes the status for several years of the individual between being non-poor to being poor. If that is the case, for each year in which he switches status to being poor, he will make a period utility loss equal to this delta UP, which is the difference between the utility of being non-poor and the utility of being poor. But there is a second channel through which the pandemic affects the individual lifetime utility, which is mortality. It can advance the year of death. So the individual could die in 2020 instead of dying in 2050. In that case, the individual will lose 30 years of life. And here, we assume, we don't know, of course, what would have been the status of the individual if he didn't die. But what we will do is that we will assume that if the individual was not dead, he would have been non-poor. And the idea is here that we don't want to value more the death of rich individuals over the death of poor individuals. We think it is unappealing. And for this reason, we assess the death of an individual. We say that it has the same welfare cost for regardless of whether the individual was rich or poor. And so now here I have described how the pandemic affects an individual. And so here, if we take social welfare to be the sum of the welfare of all individuals, so the welfare cost of the pandemic is the sum of cost on all individuals. And that means to sum for all individuals the number of additional years they spend in poverty, and for mortality to sum the number of years lost. And we see here in the equation in the slide that the mortality cost delta W over the whole society, it is proportional. It is in fact a weighted sum of the total number of poverty years and the total number of lost years over society, where the lost year must be multiplied by this normative parameter alpha I talked about earlier. And here, given our definition, alpha is the ratio of the period utility loss of dying divided by the period utility loss of becoming poor. And again, because we assume that becoming poor is no worse than dying, we will have that alpha must be equal, at least equal to one. So this is the connection between or welfare evaluation and social welfare evaluations. It is an approximation. And so now let's use this social welfare evaluation in order to assess the welfare costs as of June 2020. And we start by looking at a subset of countries, six countries. Three of them are developed countries, and the last three are developing countries. And let me first explain how do we compute our estimates in the number of lost years and number of poverty years. So in order to estimate the number of lost years, we take the number of COVID deaths by each category in June. And then for each of the deaths, we compute what is the residual life expectancy at the age of death. And then we make a sum over all the lost years. Then whenever we want to compute the number of poverty years induced by the pandemic in these countries, how do we do it? So we start from forecasts of GDP for the year 2020. So before 2020, so before the pandemic, we had a couple of forecasts which tells us what would have been GDP in 2020, what were the expectations without COVID. But then 2020 starts and the COVID pandemic hits, and the new forecasts have been computed. And these new forecasts, they include the impact on GDP of the COVID crisis. And so the recession, what we estimate to be the recession due to COVID is the difference between the GDP forecast for 2020 without COVID and the GDP forecast taking into account COVID. And so then if we want to compute what's the additional poverty due to this recession, we will need to make a few assumptions on how the recession is distributed in the population. And here we make one strong assumption, which is that the recession is distribution neutral. So it means that if we have a 10% recession, it means that the income of all individuals in the society are 10% smaller. Clearly, this is a very strong assumption, especially in the high-income countries that have enacted substantial social policies aimed at easing the social impact of coronavirus. That is clear. And it is also probably a strong assumption when we look at developing countries, because so the available evidence up to now shows that the poor, they are more than proportionally hit by the crisis. So at least if we look at a paper by Bonavida and Gabarini in Argentina, where they show that the poor in Argentina have been more than proportionally hit by the crisis than the rich. And so, but this is the assumption that we make in order to form an idea of the poverty impacts. And so given the income distribution that we know for each country in 2019, we can scale the distribution to 2020 given the forecast in GDP and compute what is the number of poor individuals given the national poverty threshold. We can do it for the forecast that doesn't take into account COVID. We have a number of poor. We can then do it for the forecast taking into account COVID, and we will have a larger number of poor because of the recession. And the difference between the two is the additional number of poor that come from the recession. And in order to obtain a number of poverty years, we need to make assumption again on how many years they will stay poor. And here we will make a conservative assumption, which is that their poverty will only last for 1 year. This is the same as assuming that we have a V-shaped recovery. And this is conservative in the sense that in the end, we will show that the poverty costs are of paramount importance. And so here, by making this assumption, we reduce a bit our estimated poverty costs. Okay, so this is the way in which we estimate the number of lost years and the number of poverty years as of June 2020 in these six countries. And then we want to look whether one source of poverty, of cost is dominant or not. And given the fact that welfare costs are proportional to the sum of the number of years, we can show that, so we have that the poverty costs, they will be dominant if it is the case that the fraction of poverty years divided by the lost year, which is an empirical ratio that we call the break-even alpha hat, if this empirical ratio is larger than alpha, then it means that poverty costs are dominant. So if you think that one lost year is equally bad as three poverty years, and we observe that there are 10 times as many poverty years as last year, then we must conclude that poverty costs are dominant in these countries. Before showing the result, here this graph informs you on the distribution of death in different age categories in the case of Sweden as of June 2020, and where we see that most death, COVID-induced death, they take place above 70 years old, which as a result imply that there are relatively little, the number of years of life lost due to one death is smaller than what it would have been if the mortality or the deaths were equally split in the population. So in a sense, what this graph shows is that whenever we want to look at the welfare consequences of mortality, if we ignore the age distribution of death, which is very much concentrated among the old, we tend to inflate the welfare costs when we ignore this age distribution of death. Okay, so here are the results for our six countries. And so if we look at Belgium, for instance, we see that it has a high GDP and that it has also a population pyramid with people that are pretty old because the mean age is 40 years. Whereas when we compare it to low-income countries, it is always below 40 years, even below 30 years. Then we can compute, so here I give you the figures that are used in order to compute the number of lost years, and we have 9,000 deaths multiplied by an average number of lost years per death of 10 years, which then give us the number of lost years. So the recession, COVID-induced recession, is about 8% in Belgium, and that gives an additional poverty of about 3%. And when we put, so when we multiply the population by this additional 3%, we have our number of additional poverty years. And when we divide the estimated number of poverty years by the estimated number of lost years, we have a break-even alpha hat, which is 3.5. And so this is what we obtain for Belgium, but then for Sweden and UK, two other developed countries, we obtain break-even alphas that are close to 10. And for developing countries, the break-even alphas that you obtain are closer to, are above 10 or even above 100. And so this shows that, at least for these developing countries, it is clear that the poverty costs are dominant. So for Belgium, it will depend on what is the value of alpha that you think is relevant. So what we then do is to compute the same thing, but for all countries in the world. And so that there are small differences in the way in which we compute it. So first, we don't use national poverty threshold, but we divide countries by income categories. And for each income category, we use the poverty line that is proposed by the World Bank for this category of countries. And the second difference is that we don't necessarily have the distribution of the COVID-induced death into each categories. And so we need to make a few assumptions in order to retrieve this distribution of death. And typically, the assumption that we make is that the probability to catch the disease is the same in each age category. And then once you catch the disease, we assume that your probability to die is the one that has been documented in China or in France, where the infection to fatality ratios have been assessed after the first wave of COVID. And that allows us to make a distribution. And in the end, we obtain this graph here, which shows our break-even alpha hat, which is the empirical ratio of the number of poverty years divided by last year, which is on a logarithmic scale as a function of GDP. And the first thing which is striking here is that for most countries, we have that this value is above 10. And for many countries, for half of them, it is above 100. So it is clear that whenever it's above 100, that the poverty costs are clearly dominant. But for some countries, like for Belgium, we have smaller values, and then it is ambiguous and we cannot tell. Okay, so we should also pay attention not to draw too many conclusions from this graph. First of all, it is hard to compare different countries because in June they were not at the same stage of the epidemic. And second of all, it doesn't mean that because we observe that the poverty costs are dominant, that it means that no intervention would have been better. Because here, the mortality costs computed, they take into account the policy responses and the lockdowns. So if we want to compare them, we will have to set up a no intervention scenario, which is what I turned to now. So our no intervention scenario is based on the idea of herd immunity, which is the idea that at some point, at some infection rate, the disease does not have more hosts in order to propagate itself and just stops. Of course, we don't know yet scientifically whether there is herd immunity for COVID-19, and especially we don't know for how long it would last. But here we make the assumption that it does work, and this is conservative because we will want to show that that no intervention was not such a good idea. So let's assume that it does work. And so in order to build a scenario, we also need to select an infection rate at which herd immunity stops the disease. And here we take the 80% infection rate from studying the Lancet published by Banerjee et al. Of course, this 80% infection rate is a bit high, and we will look at a lower infection rate for robustness. We will look also at 50% infection rate. And then the way in which we compute the estimated number of year lost is as follows. So we assume that each category has an 80% infection rate, and then we use the infection to fatality ratio documented for China for developing countries and from France for developed countries. And we look at two scenarios, but we will mostly, our baseline scenario is the scenario where hospitals are saturated, which is we believe that it is what would have happened if we had gone for herd immunity. And when hospitals are saturated, of course, this implies that if you need intensive care unit, you will not have access to it and you will die. And this inflates the infection to fatality ratio documented for China and France. And so what we find is that the potential mortality burden associated to herd immunity are much larger in high-income countries than it is for low-income countries. And the main reason comes from their different, very different population pyramids. Just to give you an example, if we compare Japan with Zimbabwe, and we look at the fraction of the population that is above 60 years, it is 1/3 in Japan, whereas it is only 5% in Zimbabwe. And when we compute the expected number of years lost in Japan under the saturation scenario, we obtain 6 times as many lost years per capita as the number we obtain in Zimbabwe. And even more, if we assume that under herd immunity, Zimbabwe's hospitals are saturated, whereas it is not the case in Japan, it is still the case that the number of years lost per person are 3 times larger in Japan than they are in Zimbabwe. So we have very different potential mortality burdens as a function of GDP. So we also need to make an estimation of what would have been the number of poverty years under no intervention. And this is very hard to do. And in fact, we will not try to do that. We will instead make the conservative assumption that there is no poverty consequence of no intervention. And it is conservative in the sense that we will show that even without poverty years under no intervention, no intervention still has higher welfare costs, at least in high-income country. And then, from our welfare analysis, we have that no intervention has larger welfare costs if the following inequality is satisfied. And that can be, so you can rewrite this inequality then as a function of this second inequality, where we compare a second empirical ratio that we call break-even alpha tilde with your true value of alpha. And break-even alpha tilde is the number of poverty years as of June divided by mostly the number of last year and donor intervention. So that is what we compute. And this is the result that we observed in the whole world. So again, we have the empirical ratio break-even alpha tilde in the vertical axis, which is given in logarithmic scale, and we have countries as a function of GDP. Okay. What I forgot to mention is that this break-even alpha tilde, if we observe that it is smaller than one, because we have that alpha must be at least as large as one, because being dead is no better than being poor, then we can conclude unambiguously that no intervention has worse welfare consequences. And this is precisely what we observe for the vast majority of countries, and especially in high-income countries. So we observe that our empirical ratios break-even alpha tilde, in most countries, they are smaller than one. And in the majority of countries, they are very far away from one, in fact. So if you look at high-income countries, this ratio, they are smaller than one half, or even they're close to 0.1. And when it is the case, it is clear that no intervention has worse welfare consequences, regardless of your value of alpha, provided it is above one. But we cannot, so for these countries, we can unambiguously conclude this, but it's not the case for some low middle income countries in blue or in green, where the value of the break-even alpha tilde is above one. Then whether it would have been better or worse to have no intervention is ambiguous. We cannot conclude here. Okay, another aspect we investigate quickly in our research is here we take different income standards to define poverty. So the poverty line in high income country, it's $21 a day, whereas it is only $2 a day in low income countries. And still we have that the relative magnitude, so that our break-even alpha tilde, we see already a negative slope as a function of GDP. This negative slope, which shows that the trade-off is clearer in high-income countries, it is even reinforced whenever we use the same poverty standards in all countries. That is, whenever we use, for instance, the extreme poverty line for all countries, this extreme poverty line, which is $1.9 a day. So this is what the next graph shows. It is the same graph, except that we use the same poverty line in all countries. And then it is especially clear for high-income countries now that the break-even alpha tilde, they are below 0.1. And then under this definition of poverty, there is no doubt that no intervention would have been much worse in high-income countries. So before concluding, let me maybe show the same results, but under the 50% infection rate, which is a robustness test. And what we see, so because this 50%, because 50% infection rate implies smaller mortality in case of no intervention, it will increase our break-even alpha tilde. And so it is less often the case that their value is below one. And so we can less often conclude that no intervention would have been worse. But, but if we focus on high-income countries, for nearly all of them, we still have that our empirical ratios are below one. And also remind that we made the conservative assumption that herd immunity would come without any poverty cost, which is clearly unlikely. Okay, this is the same thing here. So let me wrap up what I have shown in order to finish in the 40 minutes time slot. So what we have been trying to do in this research is to estimate the current welfare consequences of the pandemic. And we start by doing this as of June 2020. And our main finding there is that economic costs through their poverty implications, they are likely to be the welfare, the largest source of welfare costs in most countries. Then when we compare what are the consequences that you observe with those of a no-intervention scenario, in many countries, and especially in high-income countries, we show that no intervention would have had worse consequences. And finally, We observe that the more developed a country is, the larger are the mortality costs and the smaller are the poverty costs. And so it points in the direction of showing that the best policy response might be more targeted towards containing infections in rich countries and towards containing poverty in poor countries. So thank you very much for your attention. I will stop here.
Thank you very much, Benoit. We have plenty of time for questions now. Well, not plenty of time, but somewhere around 20 minutes, so you did very well. We have one question in the Q&A, but for now I would encourage other people listening to the seminar to send their own questions in the Q&A as well. The first question is from José Navarro, which asks, COVID-induced deaths are allegedly widely undercounted. Could the same exercise be done with excess death over the normal death rate?
Okay, that's
would you like to collate questions or would you prefer to take them one by one?
I think it would be best one by one, otherwise
okay.
I don't forget. And this one, it's a very good question. And indeed, it is true that we base our estimation of number of lost years on the reported number of COVID-induced deaths, which are different, as has been now shown, from a better estimator, which is the excess death. And it is clear that we would get better estimates by looking at this excess mortality. But at the time when we performed this exercise, this excess mortality was not available yet, at least, certainly not in all countries. So this is why we started in that direction. A second maybe piece of information is that it is clear that it would be better to look at excess mortality. But here we are interested in order of magnitudes. So to the extent that the true number of deaths is not underestimated by 10 times or by 5 times, we should not expect the whole figure to be reversed, or main finding to be reversed. But totally, I totally agree with this comment. The exercise would be better if it had been performed with excess mortality rather than reported mortality. That's a very good point.
Okay, and we have another question from Catherine Gassio at the University of Essex. There's a lot of discussion on the comparability of COVID-related data. How comparable are the used statistics on COVID deaths across countries?
It's a question that goes in the same direction. And it's clear that we take reported deaths, which are much less comparable across countries than excess mortality. And this comment is a second reason why the analysis should be performed using excess mortality instead of reported mortality. That's completely true. We should pay attention to that and try to find a solution to have better comparability across countries.
I have a question for you myself, actually. Your paper relies on a number of assumptions, which in some cases you call conservative, and some of them are very, very strong assumptions indeed, like the fact that you are assuming that poverty will just last for 1 year, or the fact that you're assuming that the economic shock will be neutral in terms of income distribution. To what extent did you test different scenarios and did that change your results?
Yes, okay. We have looked at what would have happened in case there is an increase of inequality as a result of the economic shock. And so the paper, the Argentinian paper I referred before, they documented that the economic shock led to an increase of 3.6% of inequality in Argentina. And we took this scenario in order to see what was the impact on our result. And so instead of saying it is equally distributed, we said, okay, it increases inequality by 3.6%. And then clearly the impact of such of this new assumption is to increase the poverty impact of COVID-19. And so it will only reinforce the conclusion that as of June 2020, the poverty are the dominant poverty is the dominant source of welfare costs in the countries for which inequality increases. Then you raised a question, the same question for another assumption, which is that whether poverty will stay for 1 year or for several years. Again, if we assume that it lasts for several years, then it will reinforce again the channel of poverty and make this this channel an even larger source of welfare costs. But this we haven't looked at what would have been the, so we haven't tried to assess for how many years the shock would increase poverty. So I have no quantitative answer to this question.
Okay, there's a further question in the chat that goes very much in the same direction about if inequality may impact the poverty and mortality link alongside GDP. Many of these questions are sort of going in the direction of the assumptions and the different scenarios. Is there anything you want to add to your answers?
Sorry, could you repeat the question again?
It's very similar. Alongside GDP, inequality may impact the poverty mortality link.
Yes. Okay. So whenever we look at the impact of a recession on poverty, we take into account the inequality in the country because we start from the income distribution of the country. So it is clear that if you have a very unequal country, you are likely to have many people that are just above the poverty threshold. And then for a given economic shock, there will be a larger increase in the head count ratio. And so a larger impact estimated in terms of poverty. So I would say that to the extent that we start from the existing distribution in the country, we take into account inequality. But here we've chosen to express the costs as a function of GDP because we have found that with GDP, not only is there smaller poverty impacts when GDP increase, but also we have much more mortality as a function of GDP due to the fact that countries with higher GDP have older population and larger remaining life expectancy at a given age of death.
Great. And another question from Catherine. Do you think that the difference in poverty definitions, whether these are consumption-based in developing countries or income-based in developed ones, plays a role in your results?
Okay, the definition in poverty will definitely play a role in our results. Because it is clear, so if you look, for example, at high-income countries, so whenever we look at the poverty consequences using the 21-point-something dollar a day line of the World Bank for this category of country, you have significant poverty consequences. But whenever you assume for this country that the poverty threshold is $1.9 a day, you have insignificant poverty consequences because incomes are so much above this threshold. So it's clear that it will play a role there. Another maybe more subtle comment that should make is that the value of alpha that I started to talk about at the beginning, it is clear that it will depend on the exact definition of poverty that you take into account. So if you take into account a very frugal definition as that of the extreme line of the World Bank, it is clear that falling below that line is much worse than just falling below the $21 a day line. And as a result, whenever you look at a very extreme line, you will probably have a value of alpha that is smaller, because you will say that it's a smaller number of poverty years that will be as bad or equally bad as the last year. So the definition of poverty will play a role as well there. But then the question was much more about whether we look at income poverty rather than consumption poverty. This is probably a question that will be much better answered by my colleagues, by my co-authors, Francisco Ferreira or Daniel Malheur. So I'm not so sure in which direction it would go. So I cannot answer this question.
Yes. Okay. You know, In all the poverty counts that the World Bank puts out, they use these poverty lines that Benoit has been talking about, particularly the 190 for the extreme poverty, but then also nowadays these slightly higher lines, or quite considerably higher lines, for different categories of countries, right? So 320 for the lower middle income countries, 550 for the upper middle income countries, and a much higher line at 21 something for higher high income countries. And the distributions that are compared to those lines are primarily distributions of household consumption per capita in poorer countries and household income per capita in either higher income countries or some middle income countries, particularly in Latin America. This has always been a problem. It's a long acknowledged problem. The reason it's still done is that most of these countries that where we use income data either don't collect consumption distributions or strictly prefer to use income data themselves. And so we, you know, the World Bank goes along with that. Inequality is almost always higher when you use income distributions rather than consumption distributions. For poverty, it really is a mix, in part because of a lot of zero incomes that people observe, which then sort of tend to add to poverty. So I would say, kind of, you know, guessing here, but I would say that certainly in terms of orders of magnitude, it would not make a huge difference if we did have consumption data for all countries or income data for all countries. It could probably make some difference. It would certainly make a difference as to who gets classified as poor. But in terms of the broad aggregates, I would guess that it would not make a huge difference. I hope that helps a little bit. Thank you.
Chico, since you're on the line and we don't have any further questions in the Q&A, I just wanted to loop back to the policy responses that arise from this paper, which Benoit mentioned in the presentation. So he concluded that policy responses might be targeted more towards containing infections in rich countries and poverty in poor countries. Now, one of the sort of things I couldn't help thinking while reading the paper was that really poor countries don't really have a choice in terms of what's going on, because apart from China, it was the rich countries that were affected first by the COVID crisis. And so it seems that even those countries which didn't really have that many problems with the COVID crisis, their GDP collapsed anyway, just because economic activity in rich countries collapsed. So I'm not sure how much freedom they have to define their poverty, their policy responses in this context. In terms of the World Bank, what conclusions do you think they would draw from this, you know, more specifically from this paper?
Well, fortunately, I can't speak for the World Bank anymore, but I can say what my take on this is, and it's related to what Benoit said at the beginning, which is that in this paper, we really don't make any conclusions about specific policies because we are not evaluating specific policies. And as he said, a number of policies would probably have been very good both for lowering mortality and for lowering the poverty costs. And he mentioned the vaccine, but there are others, right? Like a good test and trace system or a contact tracing system early on in the pandemic did actually help reduce both the economic costs and the mortality costs in places like Korea, for example. So there are a number of policies which are quote unquote win-win. But there are some policies, some policy responses which are not, and lockdowns in particular, or different varieties of lockdown and sort of isolation policies and policies that restrict movement and therefore restrict consumption. And in some cases also restrict production. Those measures do have a trade-off in the sense that they may reduce contagion, but also increase the or you know expand, enlarge, enhance the reduction in economic activity. And for those, I guess what we're saying, I mean, Benoit, it'd be interesting to hear Benoit on that if there's time, but my sense is that it just shows the design of these lockdowns need to bear in mind the effect on the poor. I think two good examples, I've mentioned this before in other contexts, two good examples of how not to do a lockdown were those done in India and Peru. In India, just this idea of a complete lockdown that when you have lots of migrant workers in the cities that then become homeless, that don't have a job, that are starving and therefore are forced to walk back to their villages in some cases, thereby both bringing the disease in some cases, but also, with huge exacerbated effects on poverty. So I think the kinds of conclusions that can be made from this paper are merely at a very general level, that when you are designing these kinds of policies in poor countries, you ought to pay a lot of attention to the effect that that will have on poverty, because the poverty costs are very, very substantial. I don't know, Benoit, if you want to comment on that.
No. Thank you very much with your analysis on policy conclusions or not. No, I have nothing to add.
Great. So we should conclude this event. We're bang on time. So thank you very much, Benoit. Wonderful to have you with us. A fascinating paper, and the paper is available on the Inequality website. Somebody just asked about it. And the title of the paper is Lives and Livelihoods. So that's what you should search for on the III website. So thank you all very much for coming, and have a wonderful rest of the day. Bye.